From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one couple's experience of recovery after COVID-19, relearning everything from walking to communication.
They tried the alphabet board, and I was so weak. I would try to point at A, but I would be on the second row with like L or M, and it was really difficult.
Also, the State Capitol Commission makes a decision today whether open carry can be regulated on statehouse grounds. After several days of study and legal opinions,
They punted.
We'll touch base with who's got the ball next. And Michigan's Artists Make House Calls, a YouTube series of studio visits with some of the state's most creative minds.
It seemed imperative, really, that we find a way to be responsive and reach out, even though we didn't have a physical gallery space.
Those stories and more coming your way in just a few minutes on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, a decision about guns at the State Capitol building gets deferred. We'll have the latest on dueling legal opinions later in the show. But first, state health officials say more than 22,000 people in Michigan have now recovered from COVID-19. But what does recovered actually mean? And what does that recovery look like? Michigan Radio is part of a COVID-19 collaboration with Bridge Magazine and the Detroit Free Press. Joining us today from the Free Press is Kristen Jordan Seamus. She recently published a story about one couple, David and Charlunda Thompson, and their life after COVID-19. Kristen, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me on air today and for sharing their story.
Hey, Kristen, tell us a little bit about this couple. Who are the Thompsons?
So the Thompsons are a couple from Inkster, and they met at church. They've been married for nearly 20 years. Charlunda is 45, and she's a hospice care worker. David's 42, and he's a middle school math teacher. They sing together in the church choir, and they do, well, like a lot of couples, almost everything together. And they got sick together, too.
So I read in the story that in March, both of them started feeling symptoms of the virus, but it sounds like they didn't realize just how bad it was going to get.
That's true. They had all the classic COVID symptoms. They had fever and shortness of breath and coughing. Both of them said they had an altered sense of taste and smell. They went to the hospital together, but Charlunda was admitted first. And the day after Charlunda was hospitalized, David nearly died at home. His sister kept calling to check on him, but she called EMS when he stopped answering his phone. He was non-responsive, and then he was hospitalized for 8 days. David's sister is a hospitalist in Grand Rapids, and she really managed their care remotely. She got Charlunda into Mary Freebed, but David didn't get that kind of rehab. He was discharged home, and he said he was so weak, he couldn't really even take care of himself. His family brought him food, and they tried to check in. But all he really ate or drank for days were Gatorade and hot Cheetos. That's because he said he didn't have to do anything to prepare that. Those were the only foods that he could also really taste anymore.
I had to have a trash can on the side of my bed to use the bathroom in at first because I couldn't walk. You know, for the first week, I was trying to do exercises on the side of my bed just to kind of get myself going, but I just couldn't. You know, a lot of it is the breathing. It's hard to do anything if you can't breathe.
Now, while this was going on, Charlunda was on a ventilator for 16 days. Kristen, we know that the odds of survival plummet for people who have to be intubated, but what does it mean if you do manage to get off the ventilator?
Well, being on a ventilator, especially if you're on it for a long time, like Charlunda was, it can do a lot of things to the body. It can weaken your muscles and cause the skin and nerve damage. It can even affect your memory and your cognition. Charlunda says when she first got off the ventilator, she couldn't even hold a pen.
I was thinking I was writing, but she was like, honey, I don't know what you're saying. And then she showed me the paper and it was like, and then they tried the alphabet board and I was so weak. I would try to point at A, but I would be on the second row with like L or M, and it was really difficult in the beginning.
This is so crazy. So this is obviously the point at which rehab comes in. Are we very well set up to get COVID patients the help that they need once they're well enough to leave the hospital?
Well, most rehabilitation centers and skilled nursing centers initially didn't want to take COVID-positive patients. There was a legitimate concern about exposing the already vulnerable people who live in those settings to a virus that's highly contagious and would likely cause severe disease or death for them.
Well, now that we know a little bit more, what's going on with the demand for rehab beds?
Well, as the surge in coronavirus cases began to level out a little bit in southeastern Michigan, many facilities and hospitals began to see a really huge need for rehab. And it was clear that these patients were not ready to go home. Mary Freebed opened its COVID rehab unit in mid-April for patients who test positive. It has 18 beds, and it started admitting patients from the east side of the state pretty quickly, including Charlunda. And now other health systems are finding ways to get their coronavirus patients the rehab they need. But it really did take some time.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Kristen Jordan-Shamus. She's the author of a recent Detroit Free Press article about David and Charlunda Thompson and their recovery from COVID-19. How are David and Charlunda doing right now?
They're doing better, but recovery's been slow. Charlunda was released from Mary Freebed on Wednesday, and David traveled across the state to get her. It was really quite a scene to see them greet one another for the first time in almost 2 months. David had pulled up in front of the hospital, and I could see his hand on the steering wheel of the SUV, and there was a pulse oximeter that was hugging his finger. It was measuring his blood oxygen level to make sure that he was okay, and there was an oxygen tank in the front seat of his car.
Jeez. It had to feel pretty great for them just to get outside at that point.
It really was such a beautiful day, too. The sun was shining, and it was really warm. The door of the COVID recovery unit opened up, and Charlunda stepped outside. She was given the choice to walk or be pushed in the wheelchair, but she chose to walk the whole way. And the Mary Freebed medical staff lined the path toward David, clapping and cheering for her. And she put her hand over her heart as she walked. She thanked everybody for taking care of her. And as she made her way down to the drive where David was waiting, they got to see one another for the first time in 45 days. And they immediately wrapped their arms around one another in this great big hug.
I'm sorry about that, man.
That's okay. We got this. We got this.
I love you too.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh. Feels like my wedding day all over again.
Oh, that's exactly what she said.
I'm just so grateful that I still have him.
So, Kristen, now the Thompsons are both home. What will they be having to do at home to continue building their strength back up?
Some of the exercises are pretty technical. David already has a therapist who dances with him and walks with him to try to get a little farther each session. But Charlunda was also advised to sing to improve her lung power. Take a listen.
Okay. Thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road and back again. Your heart is true. You're a pal and a confidant. And if you threw a party, invited everyone you knew, you would see the biggest gift would be from me. And the card attached would say, thank you for being a friend.
Nailed it. Good job. Isn't she a beautiful voice?
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Man, she is so amazing. Actually, both of them are. So how did you meet the Thompsons?
So I had a relationship with Chris Mills, who works at Mary Freebed. I've worked with him on other stories before, especially the one about Savannah DeHart, who is the 15-year-old girl who lives out near Kalamazoo, and she had EEE, that Eastern Equine Encephalitis.
Right.
So back in January, I went out to Grand Rapids to meet her and her family and tell the story of her recovery from EEE. And since we had a good relationship from that story, he reached out to me to tell me that they had this really great person in Charlunda Thompson, and he offered to share her story with us.
What was it like following them through this time in their life when, I mean, they had just clawed themselves back from the edge of this illness?
Really emotional. I guess I didn't realize how very sick, even when you've been discharged from the hospital, you can be. I know that COVID can do a lot of things to a lot of people, and it can be really, really wicked. But I didn't expect that when you went home from the hospital, you would still be that ill.
Yeah. And there are some long-term effects associated with the virus, too. Charlunda and David know anything about, like, how their internal organs fared during all this?
They both aren't really very sure. David said he has follow-up scheduled with various doctors and specialists who will have a look at his lungs and his heart and his various other organs to see what the long-term impact might be. The doctors at Mary Freebed were really hopeful that Charlunda might make a full recovery, but again, she's going to need much more evaluation. And since this is a brand new virus, nobody really knows what the long-term effects might be.
Well, it certainly sounds like it's going to be a while before either of them could consider something like going back to work.
Right. And that's a big question. I think David has been doing some things actually remotely with some of his students. Charlunda mentioned that he's been trying to get back online and do some teleworking with students at his school.
That's the one thing you can do from a recovery bed, I guess. Do you think you'll be able to check in with the Thompsons again?
I hope to keep in touch with them and to see how they're doing and continue updating this story as it goes on.
Do they have family who can sort of help them through this recovery stage?
They really do. They're very fortunate that they have a very close-knit and tight family. David's sister in Grand Rapids was really instrumental in saving their lives. And then Charlunda's sister, who lives here in southeastern Michigan, she would go over and check on them. She was leaving groceries on their front porch. She was the one who raced over there when David's sister called and said she couldn't get him to answer the phone. She raced over and waited for EMS to come and made sure that he got to the hospital okay.
Kristen, it's just an amazing story. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thanks again for taking your time today to share it with others.
Kristen Jordan Seamus writes for the Detroit Free Press. Coming up, artists making house calls during the pandemic. Not to worry, they're not actually coming over. Just offering a fascinating look inside their work and their creative processes.
We have our guard down in a way, and maybe it's partly because of this shared vulnerability, but also just this frank conversation sets you up to take down whatever the pretense might be.
We'll tell you about the ongoing web series after a break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For a lot of us over the past 2 months, digital modes of communication have become the new normal. And that's also true for folks like artists, who tend to count on in-person interaction as an important piece of their work. The Institute for the Humanities at the University of Michigan has developed a YouTube series of studio visits with regional artists to create some of the connection that so many of us have been missing. The artists get an honorarium for their time, and viewers get a close-up experience with some of Michigan's most creative minds. With us now is Amanda Krugliak. She's the arts curator at the Institute and co-host of the video series, which is called House Calls. Amanda Krugliak, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks so much.
You know, it's funny. I think a lot of people assume that artists totally thrive on all this time to be alone and making. And I mean, I'm sure that's true for some people, but would you say that there are plenty of artists out there who find this as challenging as people in any other line of work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that all of the artists that we've spoken to thus far really initially wanted to frame it that this was maybe like a residency or a time they had imagined to work. And in the course of the conversation, it became very clear that this is really hard, and it's hard to try to juggle work and kids homeschooling, and just spiritually, it's a challenging time for everybody.
The concept of studio visits is really important to art and artists and curators, but that term of art isn't maybe that well known for people who maybe don't work in contemporary art. Could you explain what a studio visit is and what its sort of what its function is under normal circumstances?
Yeah, normally I think of a studio visit as this opportunity to have a conversation about an artist's work. Typically, the studio would be set in a certain way, or maybe we would have these esoteric conversations about art and what they're doing and the shows coming up or a particular project. So under normal circumstances, it's a way to engage with that artist, but doesn't always take you to a more personal place. So the twist on house calls is it's really playing against that idea of what a normal studio visit would be like, and we're seeking out something that's more personal.
The conversations in house calls have definitely run the gamut. You get to learn everything from what kind of space each artist works in to what their thoughts are on what's happening right now and the kind of work that they are making, but also why their favorite animal is the saber-toothed tiger or just literally every little thing that seems to inform what people are working on right now. Can you explain a little bit about how you got this rolling?
Yeah, absolutely. We had received support from the Andrew Mellon Foundation to do a regional art exhibition. And then when we were suddenly in this place of isolation and feeling adrift, it seemed imperative, really, that we find a way to be responsive and reach out, even though we didn't have a physical gallery space. So we pivoted this project of the exhibition in the gallery, and we decided to come up with a series virtually that would be called House Calls. And the whole missive would really just be to come in as a team, because now working as a team really felt important to us, too.
So, Amanda, as part of House Calls, you conduct an online interview of the artists and post it online. But it's not just you alone. You're joined by two co-hosts, or co-curators, I guess, Angela Abiodun and Juliet Heinle. Why did working as a team feel so important right now?
I think it had to do with us also feeling very isolated. This really brought home how much we engage with one another, even if it's just a small conversation in the coffee room or meeting other people on the Diag, you know, that there's so much that you get from other people. So we, one, just felt like we missed each other, but also it was a way for us then to connect in the same way that we were connecting to other artists. It felt, too, that everybody could bring a new voice to the project. We were inspired as well by this whole way of coming together in chat rooms, right, on a Zoom site, that if we could take that and do something innovative, sort of experimental even, with that format, where everybody would have this voice, that could be a really interesting platform.
Have the artists said anything that surprised you so far?
My goodness, I guess it surprises me that people are doing anything at all. Like, from my perspective, that it's really, you know, amazing for those who have been able to continue to produce. I think that artists very clearly state that for them, beyond their own creative work, they value family and the security and safety of their families. So that came through very clearly for all of the artists. So not so much a surprise, but certainly something consistent. Gardening felt like something everybody turns to feel more settled, to find hopefulness. And that was something, I suppose, that surprised me, that at least two of the conversations landed on gardening.
The name of the series, House Calls, evokes an image of doctors, you know, back in the day, going into patients' homes to provide care and creating a layer of intimacy that a lot of us don't necessarily have with our primary care docs right now. You're meeting digitally with artists in their personal spaces. Would you say that adds a layer of intimacy to the conversation?
I think it was absolutely what we hoped for, and certainly what I've discovered, that there's a way that this allows us to come together. The first episode, if you look back on it, it was just critical that we saw Sarah Rose Sharp's face. We checked in, like, are you there? Are you there? Even though initially it may seem that we're at a distance through virtual programming, that we can also pare something down to the necessity, to the bare bones, that we're more transparent, we're more honest, we might engage in ways that otherwise we might not in a more social public setting.
Do you find that there are things you learn in this format that you might not learn at a gallery talk?
Well, certainly working with a team has been a surprise, how gratifying that was. It's made me realize I think I've been kind of lonely out there as a curator, thinking about my primary relationship with an artist, that I've loved coming together as a team, exploring perspectives or points of view, or meeting artists that I might not have met before. And yeah, I think that we have our guard down in a way, and maybe it's partly because of this shared vulnerability, but also just this frank conversation sets you up to take down whatever the pretense might be that normally might be in place, particularly around the arts.
You know, everybody has some economic anxiety right now, I think it's safe to say. It feels like artists are just right down in the middle of that. How would you say the artists you've talked to, how are they doing?
I think they're all struggling with the precarity of being an artist, of not having systems in place, perhaps, that might exist for other professions, and then to layer that with additional financial uncertainty. You know, it intensifies their feeling of precarity. So I think all of them across the boards are concerned about that and dealing with that. You know, I do know that they have shows that have been postponed or sources of income that have dried up and things they had been planning on. And so already to be precarious where you're just looking for that next gig or that next show or to sell a piece of art, all of those things have now shifted around and there's nothing to grasp onto.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amanda Krugliak. She's the arts curator at the Institute for Humanities at the University of Michigan. She's also the co-host of the video series House Calls, which meets artists in their homes and studios during the pandemic. You're getting a chance also, though, to see the creative process, and not everyone is completely paralyzed. There was a moment in the House Call with Judy Bowman of Romulus where she shared a piece that she collaborated on with her 90-year-old mother, who she's been in quarantine with.
Yeah.
And she tells the story behind their portrait of family that they made. Can you tell us about that piece?
So I should tell you, too, that Judy is an artist that I hadn't known before, but I had heard of her or we had crossed paths. And then it was actually through Facebook and me watching her with her mother in these posts that made me reach out to her because I was so moved by these daily posts that she would share with everybody. The piece that you're talking about is a piece that she actually made with her mom, and the two of them would collaborate. So her 90-year-old mother will cut out these pieces to become part of the composition, and they both have signed it at the bottom. So just to imagine that this had given them an opportunity to come together, for her to be caretaking, and for her mother to also feel like she could engage with her daughter's work. You know, the way that that all overlaps, the dovetailing of all of that is so beautiful. And I found Judy to be so inspiring. And that's something we hadn't talked about, really, how inspiring these people are in their conversations and what that offers for everyone else.
I mean, I absolutely stop short of suggesting that there's some kind of silver lining to any of this, but it's certainly true that this experience seems to deepen some artists' work and deepen the themes that they're exploring.
It's certainly affected me in how I think about my practice as well, that for all of the projects that I have tried to do, you know, for the ambitions or whatever I thought they meant, that this project and engaging with artists in this very personal way and working with my team has really made me feel that everything else just came before. And this is really something that actually is doing something in a very different way. So I can't imagine I would return to the same way of doing.
Well, how do you think things will change for you going forward?
I'm much more cognizant of other people and the world around me and how we're all connected. you talked about a silver lining. I'm not entirely sure either that there is one, but I'd like to think that every day I'll feel vigilant in thinking about that, that we all will, the precariousness of other people and what we might be able to do, even if it's a small thing. I suppose in that sense, I'd like to think of work at this time as being restorative in a way, as mending something instead of returning to the old ways that we do things.
May I ask you about one more moment that caught our attention in the series?
Absolutely.
There was one house call with Mandy Cano Villalobos of Grand Rapids. She shows you how during her time in isolation, she's been sewing and dyeing fruit and fabric for this incredible-looking project that reimagines Greek mythology. Let's take a listen from one of the recent interviews.
I'm smelling rotting oranges right now. So I've been working on a series that has to do with mythology and how, like, this idea of embodied text or storytelling in a way that isn't necessarily verbal, and that has to do with, like, matrilineal passing down of histories. And so a lot of that has to do with me looking at, like, Greek mythology and kind of readdressing them in a way that's woman-centered. I've been sewing a lot of oranges using kind of these Greek designs and not necessarily retelling, but rethinking the story of Persephone and Hades and Demeter and these, like, relationships of mother and child and wife and husband and kind of looking at it through this feminist perspective.
Amanda, can you say a little bit about what you saw in that piece?
Yes, this idea of sewing and baking and, you know, all of these tasks or clear activities that are calming, that allow one to work through something. We've seen in these artist visits that artists are turning to that way of working, maybe for solace at this time. And Mandy has been sewing these oranges based upon mythology, and she's really tending to something in the way that she's working. It's quite extraordinary that there's a catharsis and a way to work through anxiety and emotions by just this handwork that we often think of when we think of working at home or domestic arts, that turning inward, you know, being in one's home. Many of these artists then have been working in such ways that relate to that whole tradition of domestic crafting or work or baking. And these conversations made me understand better that what makes a place vibrant are these very human exchanges. So that a place like a university is vibrant because of all the people you run into and all the discussions you have and all the ideas that are shared. So it's really that human interaction, that connection that feeds universities and communities and keeps us all creating and thinking about futures. And I hadn't made that connection really as to what was missing. You know, what was heartbreaking is what's missing. And part of that are these small things. I felt that not only in the conversations with artists, but also realizing sadness in what I've been missing as well, not being at the university.
Amanda Krugliak is arts curator and assistant director of arts programming at University of Michigan's LSA Institute for the Humanities. Amanda, thank you so much for this project and for spending some time talking to us about it.
Thank you so much.
In your online streaming hours, did you happen to catch comedian Jerry Seinfeld's recent special, 23 Hours to Kill? It was on Netflix over the weekend. His first original stand-up special in 22 years. And we were pleased to note it pours a little milk on Michigan's cereal capital. Seinfeld notes Battle Creek has always been on the cutting edge of the most important meal of the day.
That was breakfast! And in the midst of that dark and hopeless moment, the Kellogg's Pop-Tart suddenly appeared out of Battle Creek, Michigan, which, as you cereal fans know, is the corporate headquarters of Kellogg's in a town I have always wanted to visit. Because it seems like a serial Silicon Valley of breakfast super scientists conceiving of the frosted fruit-filled heatable rectangles in the same shape as the box it comes in. And with the same nutrition as the box it comes in, too. That was the hard part. I don't know how long it took them to invent the Pop-Tart, but they must have come out of that lab like Moses with the two tablets of the Ten Commandments.
And if you watched Seinfeld, you know that Jerry Seinfeld is a guy who eats a lot of cereal. Man knows his breakfast foods. Yada, yada, yada. Michigan's an innovator. Thanks for shining the spotlight on Michigan, Jerry. After the break, the Boys and Girls Club steps up for children of essential workers and those kids stuck at home.
They're showing signs of depression. They're showing signs of high anxiety. And so we pivoted our virtual club model to really just give them a mental break every day from 3 to 5 from what was going on with COVID.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Kids all across Michigan are facing so much disruption to their daily routines and support systems when schools were shut down due to the spread of COVID-19. Some of them are dealing with a lot of things at home, too. For students who count on additional programming, as in beyond the classroom, the virus has shaken up yet another pillar of consistency in their lives. With us today is Sean Wilson. He's the president and CEO of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southeastern Michigan. It's a nonprofit that provides kids a safe place to be. Sean Wilson, welcome to Stateside.
April, thank you for having me.
How are you and your staff doing?
We're doing well. We're here at one of our clubs preparing to reopen for children of essential workers next week. You know, it's been about 3 weeks of benchmarking nationally and really making sure that we could reopen in a way that, you know, has the highest safety, quality, and procedures in place. So it's a busy and important day for us.
How big of an effort is that? Do you know yet exactly how many workers' kids might need service right now?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things we've been doing weekly polls with our parents just to gauge all of their needs from childcare to food, security. And what we know from our weekly surveys is that 64% of our parents who are currently employed have to go into work, which means they're on the front lines. And right now what they're doing is they're finding other means. Like Detroiters do, they're figuring it out. They're making a way. But unfortunately, that could mean leaving their kids with an older sibling. It could mean leaving their kids with a neighbor that they may or may not know well. And so we've been receiving requests weekly for us to open up for essential workers, frontline workers. And we wanted to do it, but we also wanted to make sure that we're doing it as safely as possible, not only for the kids, but our workers. It's a big decision, you know, and we had to take our safety precautions and procedures through, you know, our board committees, our safety committee, our executive committee, our finance committee, our HR committee. And after about 3 weeks of work, we're finally ready to start taking registrations this week. And next week, we'll open our doors.
I think a lot of people are probably familiar with the after-school programs that the Boys and Girls Club offer. But what other programming and services did you have in the works before COVID-19 set in?
You know, it's really crazy because I've been on board as the president and CEO of Boys and Girls Club for about a year and a half. You know, really with the intent of reimagining the model and coming in the door, listening to our kids, listening to the parents, listening to the community, it became clear that although Boys and Girls Clubs is an important model when it comes to providing kids with a safe place, there's just an opportunity to do so much more. And so we're really in this exciting time before COVID-19 of reimagining the work that we're doing, which really, you know, allow kids to take advantage of high tech and introduce them to careers. Our whole model shifted to this economic mobility model, because what we heard over and over again is that if we truly want to help our kids, we have to help lift them out of poverty. And with, you know, close to 50% of Michigan youth living in poverty, it became clear that if we want to truly impact them, we have to impact the core root of a lot of the problems that they're faced: food insecurity, gun violence, you know, those things. And the root cause of that is poverty. And so, long story short, we had raised about $6.8 million towards reimagining our clubs. We did a phase one renovation of one of our clubs as the prototype. We're the first Boys and Girls Club in the country to offer co-working space for parents, for adults.
Wow.
We're the first Boys and Girls Club in the country to focus on vocational training for parents and adults, you know, because we wanted to get out of the mindset of, if we do our job one day in 20 years, these kids will be successful. Yes, we want to continue that, but we also want to make sure that we could do some things that would change their life today. And if you think about helping their mom or their dad launch a small business or to skill up so they can make more money, that changes a kid's life overnight. It was a really exciting time, and then COVID hit.
I know that some clubs are doing virtual sessions with the kids. What are those like?
Absolutely. So within 4 days, we launched a virtual club experience for our kids, because for so many of our youth, we are that safe place that the kids go to after school every day. They come here to connect with our staff, who are those caring and connected adults that are so important in their lives. And to just not provide any experience wasn't an option. And at first, we were trying to really mimic what was happening in our clubs day to day. But it became clear that our kids were dealing with trauma. And our staff were so amazing because they identified, like, hey, they're showing signs of depression. They're showing signs of high anxiety. And so we pivoted our virtual club model to really just give them a mental break every day from 3 to 5 from what was going on with COVID. That includes a live DJ every day. So it's an interactive dance party with the kids. And then we'll go into some kind of engagement where they're competing in virtual games against each other or doing a talent show. And then we bring on special guests to lead specific classes. It might be around STEM or STEAM, or it could be a dance class or whatnot. And that was really a strong pivot for us because it kept our kids connected and it kept our staff connected in a really troubling and scary time.
I certainly understand that the point of this, at least in part, is to give kids who may have grief and trauma in their homes some place to sort of let it out and not think about the very serious things going on in their world. But would you say that some of those emotions that they're feeling are evident when they're involved in the virtual meetings?
Well, it definitely is. You know, once again, our staff, they know these kids so well. You know, they could tell when a kid was pulling back, when they weren't engaging, when they weren't smiling, when they were demonstrating some of those signs, you know, or even things that they were saying, the kids were saying, you could pick up on it. Every Friday, we do an assessment to be able to gauge their anxiety level. And every week, you know, you're seeing over half of the kids self-reporting signs of anxiety. And so what that allows us to do is then take interventions offline. Our staff then know that that's a kid, you know, hey, April reported this. So, you know, April is someone who we need to reach out to personally and just check on. Hey, just checking on you from the club. And that goes a long way. It's also connecting with April's mom or dad to say, hey, we noticed this, you know, and here's some virtual solutions that can help. And, you know, that's what Boys and Girls Clubs are all about. Like, we're family. You know, we go beyond just the kids coming in daily and then they go home. It really is a family for these kids.
What kind of impact has the pandemic had on your financial resources?
It was brutal. $2 million hit. And the big portion of that is revenue from events. So, you know, we have an annual golf outing, automotive classic golf outing with the automotive industry that nets us $500,000 a year. And then, you know, we bring in another $500,000 from Charity Preview, the auto show. And then we have a slew of other events. And I think that's the world of nonprofit. But to have that go away overnight, $1 million of that we're counting on in May and June. But once again, we have an entrepreneurial mindset. You know, we can't control the hand that we were dealt, but we can, you know, play the hell out of that hand. And so we looked at our assets, saw what we had, and, you know, we had this amazing virtual club experience that we were building every day and growing. And we have an amazing Rolodex of influencers and celebrities that we can call on. And so we combined the two and did a virtual fundraiser, planned it in 2 weeks, really probably a week and a half, my staff would say. But, you know, I think it was closer to 2 weeks. And we raised over $300,000. We set a goal of $100,000 and we tripled our goal.
Wow.
And then we've been getting some emergency funds as well. So that's helping to close the gap some anonymous individual donors are stepping up. You know, we have a lot of alumni, everyone's stepping up. We've been around for 94 years, which means we've been through all kinds of crises as an organization. Our brand is to be that safe place. So we have to kind of stick to that, whether that's in person or virtually, it doesn't matter.
It sounds like out of necessity, you've been innovating and coming up with some pretty quick adaptations, but the process must be really challenging. I was wondering just what's getting you through right now.
You know, my family, my kids, you know, I lost a good friend the first week or so, Marlo Stoudemire.
Yes.
He's one of the first reported deaths. And, you know, that really hit me hard. You know, I get emotional even thinking about it now, you know, because he was such a good guy. And only 43 years old. Mm-hmm. And to see that, you know, him lose his life and his wife and his kids is really tough. You know, but I think what gets me through is knowing that I'm blessed to still be here with my family, for one. And then two, we still have a mission. There's still a need that the kids have in Detroit and across southeastern Michigan. And so, you know, I think it's one of those moments where you have to take a knee and, you know, let your emotions get the best of you for a minute. But then you have to pick yourself up and say, hey, you know, my family needs me. The community needs us as a staff and as an organization. And you got to push through. This is a moment where everybody is struggling. Everyone is up against the wall. And I think, but this is also the time when we can all come together and do some amazing things. This is when innovation is born. You know, new models emerge. And I would just, you know, I think it's important that we all challenge each other to be the best version of ourselves and, you know, think outside the box to create something special that comes out of this horrific moment in our history.
Mr. Wilson, thank you so much for everything that you and your staff are doing right now.
Thank you for the time.
Sean Wilson is president and CEO of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southeastern Michigan. If you were listening with us last week, you may remember we spoke with a member of Michigan's Capitol Commission about considering rules about guns at the Capitol. That consideration came after the coronavirus shutdown protests resulted in militia members and others bringing high-powered rifles to the Capitol. A number of lawmakers found the gesture disturbing. The commission met today in a public Zoom meeting to discuss possible responses. Here with us is Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hi, Rick.
Hi, April.
So the question at hand today was whether the commission, which has jurisdiction over Capitol grounds and their maintenance, has latitude to decide in what manner people can come and protest there. What did they decide?
They punted.
So what does not making a decision mean in this context?
In this context, it means that the status quo prevails, that the open carry of firearms is still allowed around the state capitol and in the state capitol when the building is open. We will see what the commission decides based on the recommendations that it gets in the future. They're looking for advice from the attorneys for the House and the Senate, the attorneys from the legislative branch. That means Governor Whitmer and Attorney General Dana Nessel and, well, whoever else they decide to consult on this issue.
There was some discrepancy between the Attorney General's opinion on this matter and that of the commission's legal counsel. Can you outline the difference of opinion?
Oh, sure. That the Attorney General, first in an informal letter to the Michigan Capitol Commission, which we should point out has jurisdiction over public areas of what's called the Capitol Mall, which is the grounds outside the halls and the rotunda. And the Attorney General said that the commission does have the authority to banish the open carry of firearms from the state capitol. And the reason for that is that Michigan's open carry law is supposed to basically control the actions of local governments. And Attorney General Nessel says, well, the Capitol Commission is not a local government. Now, the attorney for the Capitol Commission said otherwise. The attorney said that, well, even though the commission is not a local government, it is still ruled by the firearm preemption, the firearm ordinance preemption law. And so that's where things stand. And so what the commission did, and it was by unanimous vote, 6-0, voted to create a subcommittee, a work group, to check with their attorneys, with the attorney general, and find a way to perhaps harmonize these opinions or perhaps not, and come up with just an idea of what the commission is allowed to do vis-a-vis the open carry of firearms.
Did members of the commission have many comments on this dilemma before them?
Yeah, there was actually a lot of discussion that there was general agreement that the behavior of the demonstrators who openly carried at the state capitol was disturbing and not responsible. But there were disagreements, as you know, you just heard, over how far the commission is allowed to go in terms of banning firearms, the open carry of firearms, which is allowed under Michigan law. And it was whether the commission could do it on its own or whether the legislature would have to change the law and have that change approved by the governor.
Rick, has there been any reaction to the commission even considering this ban, the fact that they're willing to take up the question?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That there's been a lot of reaction, emotional, ardent on both sides of the issue of guns. Because I'm self-quarantined like everyone else, I've been following it on social media. But yeah, people who are generally in favor of stricter firearms rules are appalled that the commission punted, and actually, so are people who are on the opposite side of the question, that everyone is seeing kind of a conspiracy here.
Yeah. Was there public comment during today's proceedings at all?
There was a lot of online comment, but there wasn't testimony in the way that one would typically see in public meetings, because this was a Zoom meeting that didn't have the capacity to do that. As a matter of fact, at one point, the Zoom meeting was essentially shut down because so many people logged in to try and just keep track of the proceedings.
Wow. Well, there are more protests lined up amongst some groups and people who are displeased with the governor's stay-at-home orders. Is anyone at the Capitol worried about what the next couple of weeks may bring?
There are a lot of people who at the Capitol who are worried that, you know, we've seen statements from Democratic legislators saying that it's irresponsible to wait any longer on taking action regarding guns in the Capitol and around the Capitol. The Attorney General, Dana Nessel, said that the commission not only has the right to limit the open carry of firearms at the Capitol, but it has a responsibility to do so, not just during the COVID crisis, but also later on when, you know, that there are thousands of visitors to the building every year. And when school is in session, very often that includes busloads of kids.
Yeah. So the commission has agreed that there's going to be a study group. What are the next steps in this process?
There is no time determination on when that group is supposed to make recommendations, and so we don't really know exactly when to expect anything. And that's kind of where things stand right now, that there's supposed to be a recommendation at an indeterminate time.
Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan's public radio stations. Thanks very much, Rick.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Just a reminder that if you missed our discussion last week of the Capitol and protests and open carry, you can find us at our website or in our podcast feed. Tomorrow on Stateside, we check in how renters, landlords, and lenders are doing in week 8 of the coronavirus shutdown. Till then, that's our show for today. Producers are Laura Weber-Davis, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Mike Blank. Our fabulous interns are Leah Baldori, Catherine Newhan, Nell Scott, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.